Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Happy to have you with us on the Ideas Network today. Diana Allfuth is back with us. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Agent, or specialist, actually, for Pierce County. We're going to start off by talking about winter damage and keeping weeds down in your garden. But, of course, we will take your other art gardening questions, so join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Diana.
Hey, Jill. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too, even if it is by Zoom or Meet.
It's a beautiful day up here. I think it is across the state, and it's going to be an amazing weekend weather-wise, so everyone can get out and do the last planting and all the good stuff outside.
So, yeah, for sure. It's great here, too. Garden centers are going to be busy this weekend, I think.
That's for sure. And everyone who's been starting tomatoes inside and stuff, we always say that Memorial Day weekend is when you should plant them out, especially in the northern half or the northern two-thirds of the state. And so this is Memorial Day weekend. So those tomatoes, hopefully you've gotten them hardened off and used to a little bit of the sunlight. And now we can count on the soil and the weather being warm enough to get them out in the garden.
Yes, absolutely. And don't make a mistake about not hardening them off, because that can hurt. Why don't you give a little more instruction on that, Diana?
Sure. So if you buy transplants from a greenhouse, they've been growing in full sun and they're fine. You can put them outside. But if you started your own seeds, whether it's tomatoes or peppers or anything else, the indoor light is not anywhere near as strong as the outdoor sunlight is. Even if you have them on a sunny window, if you have grow lights, it's not the same. So you have to get them used to that gradually. And usually we look at it as about a two-week process, where you start them with a half an hour of 9 to 9:30 a.m. sunlight, and then you increase it 15 to 30 minutes a day until you're out there, until they're out in the sun for at least 6 hours. So if you don't do that, what'll happen is once they get outside, after a couple of days, you'll start getting bleached and browned leaves, because they basically get sunburned. Those leaves aren't able to handle that strong, intense, bright sunlight. So be sure that you do that gradually. It's more about the light rather than the temperature when we're hardening them off.
That makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like Wisconsinites in Florida in January, right?
There you go, right.
Get sunburned.
Yep.
Well, we're going to talk about winter dieback. So why don't you explain what that actually looks like, so people know if that's what they have?
Sure. So there are several different forms, and every winter seems to be different for us in Wisconsin. There's no normal anymore, it seems.
No.
And this was an interesting winter, because we got cold, but we didn't get that, a week of 20 to 30 below, really, really bad cold spell. And then, especially in the northern part of the state and in my area over here in the west, we had record snowfall amounts. And so we had very little frost in the ground. And so I don't expect that we have a lot of cold injuries. But we can still have winter injury. And it can be showing up now in the form of, what happens a lot of times is things leaf out and they even blossom, and we think, oh, everything is fine. And then as we head into June and we get the warmer temperatures and the leaves are losing more moisture than they can take up, then these plants will collapse. And now that things have leafed out, people are out there noticing that some things just don't look all that great. So I don't think it's going to be so much from cold this year, but all that snow that we had really caused some damage. It broke some branches, it broke canes off, and so the branch might look okay. It might have bounced up, but if you look really, really carefully at the base of it, it might have split or cracked or something like that. So what that means is there's an incomplete connection from the roots to that branch or to the top of the tree or shrub or whatever, and eventually that'll catch up with it. So if you see something like a branch that's maybe dying back at the tip, or you know, leafed out, but now is kind of looking goofy. Maybe the leaves are smaller than normal, or it starts to wilt. Really inspect that branch all the way back. I know I have some lilacs, some Tinkerbell lilacs. So they're not the old fashioned lilacs. They're a little bit smaller, but they were just flattened with snow this year. And the shrubs have kind of bounced back up some, but when I look at the very base, some of those branches have cracked. So they're blooming, and I'm gonna enjoy the blooms and stuff. But then after that, I'm gonna have to get in there and really look at what's damaged and prune that out, so that the shrub can kind of recover and recover its shape, that sort of a thing. The other thing that we see is wildlife damage. So with all that snow, the wildlife was really hungry this year. They didn't have access to a lot of their normal food sources. So of course they took it out on our landscape plants. And it's the same kind of thing, like rabbits and voles, they will chew the bark off at the base of the tree. And this year, because we had such deep snow, I had rabbit damage on crabapple branches that are like 6 feet off the ground.
It's crazy.
It is. And so when they chew that bark off, think, you know, in a simplistic way, if you think of there being a ring of straws right underneath the bark that connects the roots to the top of the tree or the branch or whatever, if those straws get broken, then the water can't get up to the top, out to the end of the branch. And like I said, there's energy stored in the buds, and that's why they can kind of leaf out or even flower, but then they can't get enough water and they'll die off. So if that happens, my recommendation always is to just give it time, because even though there might be damage on the bark, if it didn't go deep enough, sometimes the plant can recover. If it didn't go all the way around, sometimes the plant can recover. But if that branch, you know, in a month from now is not looking good, it's dead. So then you need to prune things away. And then arborvitae really took a hit this year too from deer feeding. Again, because there wasn't access to other food with the deep snow. And with those, it's kind of, I've gotten a lot of questions about that already this spring. It's like, oh, is this going to survive? And as long as there are some green on it and some growing buds on it, that arborvitae will try to grow back. And it's going to it's just going to be a matter of time for you to see if it's going to grow back enough that you can get it back into shape and it'll be attractive to look at. If it looks like a morel mushroom now, because everything on the bottom is chewed off and there's just a little bit of growth at the top and it's ugly, well, then you're going to have to look at replacing it.
Yes, I'm debating on two of mine right now too, but my rabbits were just ravenous last year, my shrubs down to the ground. So most of them are coming back, but we'll see what happens. But anyway, let's go to the phones because we've got a number of callers waiting to talk to you. Jim in Camp Douglas, you are first.
Hello, and thank you very much for taking my call. I'm back here in Wisconsin for a couple of days, but I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm having a problem establishing a garden without things getting too burned up and hot with the climate out there. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestions of what I could do with tomatoes, zucchini, asparagus type of things.
Oh, my gosh. Oof. So having never been to Arizona, that's really tough. But the biggest thing that I would tell you is you have to counter it with moisture. You have to counter the heat with moisture. That's about all you really can do, I believe. So if you can work a lot of organic matter into the soil, that's going to help with holding moisture, and make sure that you get a soaker hose on everything so that you can water regularly. That's, you know, all I can tell you. Like I say, I've lived in Wisconsin my entire life, so I have no experience in Arizona or the Southwest. But to me, the answer is organic matter and water.
Okay. And maybe check out some of the places that sell plants or that grow things in your part of Arizona. Maybe they can give you some hints.
And certainly there's an extension service in Arizona as
think.
Well.
Yeah.
You could contact.
They know everything, Jim. So good luck. Or you could just stay in Wisconsin.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Let's go to Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I had a question about snow on the mountain. That's the common name. And it was in our yard when we moved in, like in, I'm going to say 93, 94. And in the beginning, I would just, you know, pull it out, and I kind of had it under control, not eradicated, but pretty well under control. I've lost that battle. It has spread like crazy. It's really hard to get out. The rhizomes or whatever are underground. But the sad part for me is that it has moved into a wooded area behind our house. And that still has some native spring ephemerals that are coming up now. So, I mean, it's just beyond my control at this point. It has spread so far. And I wondered if there's any, if you have any idea on how I could manage it, kill it, actually, but without chemicals.
Ooh, that's a hard one, Diana.
It really is. So snow on the mountain is a variegated form of what's commonly called bishop's weed. And it's a attractive little ground covery plant that was planted quite a bit. Oh, I'd say back in the 70s and 80s, it was really popular. And as you say, it's pretty invasive and it's hard to get under control. It does spread by underground roots, underground rhizomes. And so once you get one area cleared out, all of a sudden it pops up nearby. And you're right, it is an ongoing battle. Anything that spreads by those underground rhizomes, they store a lot of energy under there. So even though you take off the top part, it's hard to kill it out. So what you got to do is kill out those roots. And there are a couple of ways to do that depending on the situation. And you've already mentioned some challenges. So one is, of course, to just keep pulling it. The goal with killing out anything with an extensive root system is to not let it have leaves, because if you break off a plant at ground level, it's going to need to use energy that's stored in the roots to regrow. As soon as a leaf starts collecting sunlight and doing photosynthesis, it's storing energy back in those roots. So the mindset has to be to not ever let it see the light of day. And so if you keep pulling things, as soon as the little leaves start showing up or you know, just breaking them off, eventually you can exhaust the energy in that root system. Now, that's not always easy, because especially when it gets way out of control. And what you've talked about with the moving into the woods is a challenge, because there are desirable plants in there as well. But you mentioned that the spring ephemerals are in there yet. And you might consider just waiting. And those spring ephemerals, they're doing the same thing, right? They've got leaves up there that they're collecting light, and then they're going to go dormant. And that's why we call them spring ephemerals. And so once they die back, if you've got a big patch of bishop's weed, you could consider just going in there with like a string trimmer or weed whacker and whacking them all off. But you'd have to do that like to ground level and do it like every week as soon as it tries to sprout back up, because again, you're trying to deplete that energy in that extensive root system. You could even try, if it's just a big patch of just that, you could try like putting some cardboard or something over it to try to keep it from being able to sprout back and get sunlight again the rest of this summer. The spring ephemeral should stay underground okay, because they're going to be dormant. And then, you know, unfortunately, these things that spread that way, that is the places where herbicides are probably justified, because it is, you know, it's a trade-off between giving it a shot of an herbicide and killing it out versus it killing out your natives and other things and continuing to spread. So I know that's a tough decision, but there isn't any non-synthetic chemical or organic herbicide option to spray on it to kill it out. And those herbicides, again, they work by getting on the leaves, and they go through the leaves of the bishop's weed or the snow on the mountain, and it goes through the stem down to the root and kills it. So that's just a tough one. You know, that and creeping bellflower, I think, are the two biggest weed problems that everybody in Wisconsin at some point in their life experiences. So I don't have a good answer for you. I'm sorry.
Well, there's some options, Pat, but I did get rid of a patch of Japanese knotweed at a house I was at previously by cutting it down, like you said, every week, getting it as low as possible. And, you know, it takes a couple of years. I think actually it was maybe three, but it finally eradicated itself. We got one popping up every once in a while, but it takes time, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's amazing how extensive those root systems are and how much energy they can store in it. And that's just their natural survival method.
Yep, it certainly is. We're talking with Diana Allfuth, and she is the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Join in with your questions or your comments by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our on-air producer today is Clara Neipert, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us every Friday or listen again on Saturday mornings at 6. You can also go online and listen to our archives at any time. So if you missed one, they're still there. And coming up next week, we are taking Garden Talk on the road to broadcast live from Bayfield. Now, the doors are going to open at 8 a.m. and admission is free, but we ask that you register at wpr.org/presents. And then that way we'll kind of know how many people are coming. It's always such a really, really good time. So hopefully we'll see you there in person next Friday. Diana, we got a question from Joe in Washburn. It kind of had to do with the winter. And he said that this winter up on Lake Superior in northern Wisconsin, gray squirrels have debarked and devastated mainly small maple trees. Is there any information on this occurrence? Or he said any information on this occurrence would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, well, squirrels, they eat an amazing number of things. And not only do they eat little maples, because there's a lot of energy in those little buds that are at the tips of a young tree, but a lot of times they will strip the bark off of maples. So I've seen it several times where it's like a 4-inch diameter maple trees, and they just climb up and down it, and they strip the bark off of it. And nobody really knows why, but it'll look almost like a bear or something, or a porcupine was stripping, peeling bark off of it. And the only thing they can think of is, you know, that when you peel off the bark, you get at sap. And sap, of course, it's like maple, well, that's, you know, where maple syrup comes from and stuff. So there's sweetness and there's energy in there. And that maybe, you know, they take a few pieces of that stripped bark up to build their nests and that sort of a thing. So not being way up in that area, I haven't heard of any, you know, big outbreak of squirrels and heavy maples this year. But again, if they're looking for food, they go to unusual things in any given year. So it doesn't surprise me that they would attack the maples.
They're smart and they're always up to mischief. So, yes. Thanks for that email, Joe. Let's go to the phones again. And Mike in Minocqua, you are up next.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I have an oak tree that is about 25 years old. And it's up in the Minocqua area. So it's up in the North Woods. And this year, the leaves, it's usually a good shade tree, but I noticed the leaves are really small and sort of floppy, you know, hanging down. And some of the branches don't have anything on it, but there are a lot of new leaves. But I'm just wondering if that's water a shortage, because it's been real dry here, or if it's related to the disease that they're talking about, I forget what it's called, wilt. wilt or if it's related to anything else like bugs or anything like that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. So those are kind of classic symptoms of when there's some kind of a disruption of water getting from the roots up to the top of the tree. So as it's leafing out here, first thing I want to say is oaks in Minocqua, they're not totally fully leafed out yet. Because even here where we are, and we're a little bit farther south and west, the oak leaves aren't fully leafed out. So first, I wouldn't panic. But if you're noticing that especially some branches aren't leafing out at all, that does raise some concern. And again, it's the symptoms of water and nutrients not being able to make it from the roots up to those branches. And there's lots of different things that can cause that. So you mentioned oak wilt. And do you know, is this a red oak or a white oak tree?
I think it's a white oak tree. I'm not positive, okay. But I think it's white.
Okay. So red oaks are more susceptible and damaged by oak wilt than white oaks. So that's one thing. But typically with red oaks, we really see them go downhill in the middle of summer and not necessarily be a leaf out problem. But it could be. And the reason is because oak wilt is a fungal disease that gets into the vascular system and it plugs that up. And so the water and nutrients can't get from the roots up to the top of the tree. So that's why you'll see these symptoms. And if that's the case, that tree will continue to decline. It'll probably be dead by the end of the year. Okay. But there are other things that can cause this as well. One would be any kind of wound or damage to the trunk. So I would ask you to go out after the show and look at the trunk really carefully all the way from the bottom up and see if there's ever been any kind of, if there's any damage or scarring or anything like that on the trunk of the tree, because that would indicate some kind of a wound, or whether it's fresh or old, that that again has compromised that vascular system and that connection from the base to the top of the tree. The third thing is that you mentioned is, it could be just drought. And I know, like in our area over here in Pearson, St. Croix counties, we were in extreme or severe, I don't know which is the worst, drought last year for a lot of the summer and fall. And so we are definitely seeing symptoms of last year's drought. And so if you had been dry last year and you're dry now too, it could simply be that there's not enough water in the soil to get up, and that's causing these symptoms now. If it's left over from last year's drought, there could have been damage to that vascular system and the roots, making them less able to take up moisture now. And then the final thing that can cause this is sometimes if it's only on part of the tree, like half of the tree or one branch, I would suggest looking at that and seeing it. If the tree, when it was younger, it got multiple leaders and like a narrow V shape. As the trees get bigger, each of those sides of the V put on more growth, and they end up pushing against each other and kind of strangling each other. So sometimes when I get this question, when we really look at the structure of the tree, it's only one of those branches that's doing this. And that's because the other side is kind of strangling it. And usually there's nothing you can do about it at that point. Sometimes if you prune out the part that's wilting and dying, the other part still lives okay for a long time. But it's not always that simple, because that tells you that there's already quite a bit of damage in that trunk. So the symptoms are consistent with some kind of break between the roots and the top of the tree. The detective work is in trying to figure it out. The bad news that I have for you is whatever it is, there's nothing you can really do about it. Okay, so if it is a trunk wound or something, you can't fix it. You can't repair that. The only recommendation I would have is if it's dry, go ahead and water it and reduce any drought stress to the tree and keep your fingers crossed. It might pull through just fine. Like I said, it's a little early. The oaks aren't fully leafed out and everything, so it might look better later, or it might go downhill.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Good luck. Hopefully that's all that it is. Now, for those who did have a drought last year, and I know that was a lot around the state, should we be watering a lot this spring to kind of make up for that?
Well, that's a great question. And it's not quite that simple. So like in our area, as I said, we were in severe extreme drought last year. And so there might, I'm already seeing, and I expect to see more results of that. So it's not necessarily even that, oh, your tree looks bad right now. It might look okay, but because it got so stressed last fall, it may be susceptible to other things. So in the case of oaks, especially, we're really expecting over like this year and next year to see a lot of two-legged chestnut borer damage. It's an insect that lays its eggs on the trunk and the larvae get under the bark and they damage the tree. And they're a native insect on a native tree, but the trees usually aren't susceptible unless they're under stress, and that drought stress is always a bad trigger for that. And then there are some other things too that I expect to see. So over winter, though, we had record snowfall amounts. And the thing that helped us was because that, like, we got like 12 inches of snow and the ground had like an inch of frost in it. So underneath, that snow was melting and it was seeping into the soil. So it really replenished our soil moisture over winter, but now it's dry again. And so, yes, we need to be watering, not necessarily because of last year's drought, but because of this spring's drought. And, we need to water an adequate amount. So we don't want to overwater because too much water can kill a plant just as easily, if not more easily, than too little water. So the rule of thumb is that our plants want an inch of water a week. And if we don't get that by rain, then putting on some kind of an irrigation to supplement that is definitely warranted. And it is getting dry out there. So, and I think that's across the state. And I know that we are cutting hay today because there is no rain in the forecast until at least next week, Thursday. So all this warm, beautiful weather we're going to be enjoying over the weekend is not necessarily great for our landscape. So definitely pay attention to watering.
I've been doing that a lot because it's dry down here too. So thanks, Mike. That was Mike, right? We talked to? Yes, thanks, Mike. And let's go to Connie in Marshfield. Hi, Connie.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Hey, I have something for the lady with the glory of the snow. I had that way back when, long time. I'm in my 70s, and she could try, if she just wants to get rid of it, pour vinegar on it. And it might take a couple of applications, but it worked for me. And she could also try salt. A couple of applications, maybe. Actually, you can go around your yard and pour salt on your dandelions, and it'll kill them.
Okay, thanks, Connie. What do you have to say about that, Diana?
So that is a common like home remedy sort of thing. Sometimes people call it, you know, homemade Roundup and stuff. And there's been a lot of research on it. And there is truth to the fact that vinegar can kill some weeds. However, what it shows is vinegar being, it burns the leaves off of the plants, okay? So if you spray it on a weed, it burns the top off, but it does nothing to the roots. It doesn't go down in and kill the roots. So the reason that it may have worked is just like we talked about earlier, if you take off the leaves, whether you pull them off, pick them off, whack them off with a string trimmer, or burn them off with vinegar or a blowtorch, that's going to stress that plant because then it's going to need to use energy from the roots to come back up. Vinegar can work well if you've got like a crack in your driveway and you have little annual weeds that pop up and you spritz them with vinegar, it burns the top off and annuals do not come back up from the roots like a perennial weed would, like a dandelion or something like that. So that's why vinegar can work in some cases. The question that we have is if you get too free with the vinegar and stuff, as we don't know exactly what that does to the soil microbes and stuff like that yet. So there's not like good research on that, but it does have a place, like I say, mainly in the annual weeds in the driveway cracks. Salt also will, if you put some salt, I know people use that a lot for thistles. You put a teaspoon of salt in the middle of a thistle. And yes, that salt does go down in there and burn it off. Depending on the kind of thistle, it may very well kill it. So if it's Canada thistle that spreads by a big long series of underground rhizomes, it's not going to kill off the Canada thistle. But if it's like a bole thistle or a musk thistle, the kind that just grow from seed, usually they're biennials and stuff, yep, that will kill it. But so will taking just a shovel or a dandelion digger and slicing through the root 2 inches below the soil surface. We don't really like to put salt in soil because it can also damage the soil and the things growing around it. That's why things don't grow along roadways where there's a lot of salt spray and salt kick up from winter salt. And so, yes, they work in certain places, but it's not going to work on a big patch of snow on the mountain that's growing in the woods, because if you were to spray that all with salt or vinegar or something, you're going to be damaging the other plants that are there as well. So I'm not saying those don't work in certain cases, but we really have to be careful about other damage as well. And sometimes there are more effective methods available.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that, Connie. Next up is Ryan in Onalaska. Hi, Ryan. What can we help you with?
Well, I love the show, so thank you for taking my call. I want to talk about the Easter flower or the Pasch flower. We moved in the town here in Onalaska in a city park. It's very sandy. And I used to walk in the spring, and I would see lots of Pasch flowers coming up. And that population over the last 12 years has gone down to literally one flower that was left this year. And I'm wondering what would cause that population of that flower to decline. Is there anything I can do to help it?
Oh, that's a great question. So if it's declined, that means for some reason, the conditions that made it happy in the first place have changed. And, you know, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly what that is, whether it's something else that moved in and outcompeted it, whether it's management. So you said it's in a park thing. Is it like a mowed area or anything like that?
It's in a city park that all it is trails that are maintained, and, you know, yes, it's mowed, and there's lots of invasives that I help with the city to pull out of there. And so, I mean, we do disrupt the soil in areas where you are pulling up the non-natives and things like that. But the one area that they used to be in hasn't changed all that much.
Are there trees that have grown up around it? Is it getting more shade maybe?
Yeah, it is possible that you can make the argument there's more shade. But I thought it would be as a spring flower, not require that kind of sun.
Yeah, Pasch flower is really kind of like a prairie flower, so it does like the full sun. And even though they bloom in the spring, as I kind of got talking about earlier, those leaves will stay out longer, and they're the ones that soak up the sun and stuff. So if the leaves are not able to get enough sun to replenish the root system, then they're going to decline. So they do need, they are a full sun prairie flower. So it could definitely be, if they're not getting enough light, that they've gone downhill. You know, they're typically pretty well drought tolerant and stuff. So I wouldn't expect that they get bothered by like a drought situation and stuff. On the other hand, they might get bothered by the opposite. If we've had a lot of rain and the soil has been wet, that can stress them out as well. So, if they've kind of died out, the conditions have changed and they're not happy.
Okay, thanks, Ryan. Appreciate that call. Our guest on Garden Talk today is Diana Allfuth. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Join us Monday at 11. We're going to commemorate Memorial Day by talking about veterans. At 11, we'll talk with author Jennifer Cheverini about her latest book, Switchboard Soldiers. And then at 11:45, we take a look at the pretty evolving role of Wisconsin women service members. Hope you can join us on Monday for that. Right now, we've got lots of calls, Diana, so we're going to go right back there. We've got John in Poplar with a comment. Hi, John.
Hello there. I took a bunch of seed pods from our irises this last fall and propagated them successfully, actually. A nice 1,000 of them sitting in some totes. I was wondering how long before I should actually separate them and start putting them in? I know that there's no full bulbs yet. It's just the nutrients off the seed. But I'm trying to continue doing that. I have some 27 gardens and a mile and a half of handicap accessible trails I'm trying to build in our yard for people. And I'm just trying to increase our amount of plants.
Wow, you are an ambitious individual. That is exciting. I used to have some friends that kind of propagated irises, and it was kind of a family heirloom sort of a thing. So really the answer is you can, as soon as they're big enough that you can handle them, you can start separating them out and planting them out as individuals. So if you're going to plant them directly outside, obviously it's... there are more risks out there in the world for little plants out in the landscape versus in your totes, but they should be able to survive as long as you keep them well watered after transplanting. So probably the sooner before we get into the super, super hot of July is better. And it'll be really interesting to see what you end up with flower colors being, you know, given the cross pollinations and all that sort of a thing. You might get a really, really cool variety of things. But, you know, I think as soon as they've got the ability to have their own root system, you can move them whenever you're ready.
And harden them off, as we talked about before. We've got another iris question. Rocky in Wausau called, but he couldn't stay with us. They have a patch of invasive yellow flag irises that they need to get rid of. And they tried digging it out of their garden, but that was really hard because, as we know, it gets really matted. Do you have any suggestions for that one?
Yeah, if they're in a kind of like a patch sort of a thing, and they do get, you know, these massive root systems that are so hard to dig out, sometimes an option short of herbicides is to just smother them out. So put something on them again. We're trying to get them to not see the light of day. As long as the sunlight's getting to them, they're building energy and storing it in that root system. And it's just getting worse. So sometimes people will put like an old piece of carpet over it. You can do black plastic, do a thick one, because they'll push up underneath it for a little while. But the key is that you gotta leave that on there for a long time. And we're talking like at least a month to maybe even longer. If you leave them on for about a month, you take it off, everything will, you know, look dead underneath it. But sometimes those roots will shoot back up once that covering is off. So sometimes people, you know, if it's a small enough plant that they're trying to get rid of, like Siberian iris get this way too. You get this big mat of them and they stop blooming and they're really, really hard to dig out and get rid of. But if it's small enough, sometimes if you have like a big bucket or something you can put under it, anything that keeps the sunlight from getting to it and leave it on there for long enough, you will kill it up because every plant needs sunlight to survive. People buy fertilizer and it's labeled, it says plant food, but that's one of my pet peeves in life because fertilizer really isn't plant food. The plant food is the sugars that are made during photosynthesis. And that's why you can't grow a plant in a dark closet because it doesn't get sun, it starves to death. And fertilizers really are more like your one a day vitamin. It's your extra nutrients that you need. So if you can keep it from getting sunlight, you can kill it out.
Okay, thanks for the email or the call, Rocky. Lisa in Madison, you are up next. Go right ahead.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Two questions. One is about a lilac bush, and the second one is about an asparagus bed. With the lilac bush, it's a young bush. Last year we had one flower on it, and this year we had quite a few. Over the past couple of years, I've noticed that there is, maybe 2-3 feet away from the main bush, there's another one coming up. And I'm wondering if I could take a very sharp spade and sever that one from the main one and transplant it someplace else.
Yes, you can. And lilacs do that. They spread by some root suckering that goes up, and that's why the patches of lilacs get bigger and bigger and bigger every year. So yes, as long as you start to dig down and kind of see where it attaches to the parent plant and dig your way back there and go as far as you can and dig that out. As long as there's enough of a root system growing underneath that new shoot, you can transplant that out. Now, having said that, now's not the great time to do that because it would be much better if you waited until fall when things start going dormant, because when you transplant it, no matter how big of a root ball you take, you're leaving a bunch of roots behind. And we are getting into the heat of summer now with that little plant all leafed out. It needs water. And when you transplant something, ideally, it's not going to be losing all that water in the heat of the summer. So the best time for you to do that would be either this fall or next spring before it really leafs out. But you can definitely propagate that off into a new shrub.
I've had lots of luck doing that. It's kind of nice to be able to trade lilac bushes with people. Thanks, Lisa. Chris in Ottawa, what question do you have?
Hi, I have a patch of buckthorn, and I was told to buy a product called Tordon to get rid of the buckthorn. And once the buckthorn's gone, I want to plant some arborvitae where the buckthorn was. Do I have to wait a long time after I apply that Tordon to the buckthorn?
So Tordon, yes, is very often recommended for that. And are you planning to like cut the buckthorn off and then treat the cut stump?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So how that works is you cut off the buckthorn at ground level and you immediately either paint or spray on the Tordon. You can also use like a brush killer that contains triclopyr as an active ingredient. That's also very effective on it. There are, other herbicide things, but basically what you do is you only spray that on the cut stump and then it seeps into that vascular system and it goes down into the roots and it kills the roots so that the buckthorn doesn't resprout. So because of that, that herbicide is pretty, it's not in the soil, it's in that plant, okay? It's in the root of the buckthorn. So it's really not contaminating all the soil. So if you go in there and plant something else in there later, it should be just fine. Now, obviously, when you spray that cut stump, just get it on the cut stump. Don't, have a lot of overspray and stuff. But it should not be any problem at all.
Okay.
And should I wait a month to plant after that? Or can I plant a week after that?
Technically, you could probably plant a week later, but if you want to be safe, The thing is that the active ingredients in, so like 2,4-D and these brush killers and stuff, they're contact herbicides, meaning, well, they're systemic herbicides, but they work by contact in that they get on either the leaf or the cut stump and they work down into the vascular system. They don't work by getting in the soil and killing the roots. So for that reason, you shouldn't have any trouble planting very soon afterwards, okay? So if it were me, I'd plant it a week later if that's when I had time and had the plants available.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Diana, Lisa, who was on before, had a question about asparagus, and I apologize. We forgot to get back to her about that. But Clara thought that it was that her asparagus didn't do very well this year. Have you had any problems with that, or is it time for her to maybe start a new bed?
So I have heard several people saying that their asparagus just isn't really productive this year. And I don't necessarily have a reason for that other than, heck, we blame it on the weather, because we blame everything on the weather.
Sure, sounds good.
So if it's a one-time thing where, you know, it was great last year and it's just not looking good this year, I wouldn't jump the gun and go redoing the patch and digging things out and that sort of thing. I would wait and see what happens next year. And next year might be just super, super perfect. You know, it's always possible that patch didn't get enough energy stored back in it last year for whatever reason. Maybe it was drought stressed late in the fall when it was trying to store energy that would produce this year. If it's a one-time thing, I just say, oh, it's having an off year, and wait until next year to see what happens.
Okay, thanks for covering that. Next up is Daniel in Ontario, Wisconsin. Hi, Daniel.
Hello, thanks for taking my question. I got a little dairy farm that I'm trying to get going here, but a lot of my land is along a state highway and then just a township road. And on the edges of the roadway, there's a lot of wild parsnips. In the first couple of years, I was pulling it out by hand, but I got a mile worth of roadway to do that on. That's kind of intense, and people think I'm crazy. And then, you know, this year I thought maybe I could mow it down, like to deplete the root system's energy or whatever. But I'm wondering, like, what can I do? Can I do anything at all? And then is there, like, a commercial market where I could sell wild parsnips at?
Well, I think the market for wild parsnips would be flooded because that stinking weed is everywhere. But you can get it under control, and especially so. Wild parsnip is a biennial, meaning the seed sprouts and the first year it just forms a little low-growing rosette of leaves down at the ground, and you hardly even notice them. And then the second year it sends up the flower stalk and it flowers and it blooms, and then that particular plant dies. But you get a perennial patch of it because you've always got new babies coming up for each year. But theoretically and practically, if you can mow that every, you know, several times a year before it sets seed, then you can deplete the seeds that would create baby plants in the future. So mowing is absolutely an effective control option for that. The thing is that once, and usually, I forgot where you're calling from, but usually like in our area, it's in July that these things start to blossom. And you need to let that seed head get up and starting to color, and that's the time you mow them off. So you want to mow it before the seeds become viable. And with wild parsnip, if it gets far enough along and you mow it off, the seeds can continue to become viable even though they're laying there in the ditch. Okay, so sooner's rather than better. But if you do it too soon, the plant will think, oh, I didn't reproduce, so it'll send up another flower head that you then have to go out and mow back off. But that is absolutely way, it's just going to take like 3 to 4 years to really deplete it, because then you won't be having any new baby plants growing up. And that's probably the easiest thing if the area is mowable to do it that way. You know, if you're not opposed to herbicides, treating the area for the little rosettes the first year plants in fall is also an effective way to prevent flowering adult plants the next year. And then just keep in mind that it's something that, you know, you can eliminate most of it within a couple of years by just mowing. But obviously there are some seeds that will lay dormant for multiple years and more come in. Unfortunately, a lot of times they're in the ditches and stuff because when the township or the county or whatever is mowing, they mow through them and they spread the seeds to new areas. So mowing is probably your best bet in your case if the area is not too steep.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel, and good luck with that. I mean, that mowing stuff really, it really does help, but you have to be patient. So be patient, gardeners. We've been talking with Diana Allfuth on Garden Talk today. She is a UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Stay with us because there's always more to come on the Ideas Network. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. Diana Allfuth is back with us. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. What gardening questions are on your mind? Our lines are full right now, but give it a little time. 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's get right back to those phones. Kim in Madison, thank you so much for waiting. What's your question?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Okay, 20 years ago, a dear friend gifted us with a huge clump of lady slippers. We planted them at our home, and they were marvelous for 10 years. Then about we moved, and so I wanted to take them with me, and I transplanted them to my mother's house. And that was about 6 years ago. And this year, I've got maybe 40, and seriously, there's maybe 5 flowers. And I just don't know if there's something I can do. It's getting about the same amount of sun, but something's different.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, that's a tough one. And I kind of just think in terms of, okay, if this is just this year that it's doing this, then yeah, we think about it, but not, it could very well just be weather related. So they don't always read the books on what we think they want. And so it might be just the combination of temperatures and moistures and late spring and all of those sorts of things. So if you don't think the conditions have really changed much, you know, lady slippers are really picky. I mean, I am really, really amazed that you've had such great success with them, and that especially with transplanting, because they need really specific growing conditions. And typically, you know, they grow in the woods or the prairie where there's a lot of organic matter in the soil. So that is like the first thing that comes to my mind. If you don't think the light conditions have changed much, they've only been in this new location though for 6 years, I think you said. So that's not, I mean, they could still be things shaking out. My best recommendation would be to maybe put some compost around them, because that would be organic matter. So that would be mimicking what they'd be getting, you know, in the woods or in the prairie, wherever their native habitat was, and helping to make sure that they have organic matter in the soil. That helps to moderate moisture levels. It helps to moderate temperatures. And that would be the only thing I would suggest trying. And otherwise, you know, let's just hope that it's just kind of a weird weather response and that things will be better next year.
Okay, thank you very much. Kim, Patty, and Madison, it's your turn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a problem with my ferns spreading. They're jumping out of my garden, and I want to slow them down or stop them. Do you have any suggestions?
Sure. And ferns can do that. They can just be downright invasive and take over. And they've got massively strong roots and crowns. And because they're spreading by underground roots, the best thing you can do if you want to keep them in an area is put in good edging to keep those roots that are underneath the surface from growing horizontally and then popping up on the outside of the bed. So, you know, the typical black edging that's like 6 inches down and stuff, that will stop most of them, but not always. You need something even deeper in some cases when it comes to ferns. To create a wall, a below soil wall to keep those roots from growing out. So sometimes people will dig a trench around the garden and put in like some kind of a steel flashing or, you know, anything that's metal or plastic that would, again, create that barrier, that wall from those underground roots from growing out. And that's the case with not just ferns, but anything else that likes to spread a lot. Ideally, ferns are put like in a, with cement curb around them because that would keep them from growing out. And we have some other plants that are that way too, but create a barrier and then they'll have to stay where they are.
And make sure you go deep enough, too, because I've had some kind of go under things.
Right. Yeah,
where there's a will, there's a way. Thanks, Patty. We got another Patty in Eden who has a comment. Hi, Patty. Oh, we might have lost her. Okay, thanks, Patty. We've got some open lines, 800-642-1234. Rich in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
A few years ago, I began a meadow, a wildflower meadow in my backyard, not very large, 20 by 20 maybe. And I used a seed mix that I bought from American Meadows. And the first year, you're supposed to mow all the time. And so I did to keep the weeds down. And that seemed to be pretty successful. And this year, things are starting to pop up. And I met a new friend who's almost like a master gardener. And I was telling her, and she said, did that seed mix have black-eyed Susans in it? And I said, oh, yeah. And she goes, well, you're going to regret that. And then I Googled that, and sure enough, it seems like black-eyed Susan can be pretty bossy and create a monoculture. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do about it, because I do know what they look like when they're young, and I see that they're all over it. So is there anything I can do?
How long ago did you say you planted this?
Well, let's see. This is kind of like its big year. This is its third year.
Third. Okay.
Because last year I kept it mowed all last year. So.
Yeah. So that's true. When you plant a wildflower mix or a prairie, what you get the first year and the second year and the third year, it changes. And that's kind of some of the fun of it. And some of it is not necessarily that the black-eyed Susans are like being bullies and knocking out the other stuff. But a lot of times in these wildflower mixes, the seeds that are in there for the flowers are annuals. And so they grow up that quickly that first year and you get some color, but they don't reseed themselves very well because seeds need soil contact. And by the next couple of years, if those seeds fall off those flower heads, they're landing on leaves and grass and whatever, and not the soil. And so they don't necessarily reproduce. But the black-eyed Susans are really happy to do that. And they are a perennial and they come back. So very often we see prairies and wildflower mixes. I have 22 acres of prairie that we planted, and we did it through the CRP program, and they have to come out and look at it every now. And they always make comments that what they mostly see are black-eyed Susans in prairies. but that's not necessarily bad, because a lot of times you know, all the other things, the conditions just aren't good for them. However, if you wanted to eliminate some of the black-eyed Susans and open up space, if you do know what they look like, you could spot spray with an herbicide if you're not against that. But you could even just walk through there now when they're young and just, you know, pull some of them up, shovel them out. Even breaking them off at ground level is going to stress them and knock them back so that other things around it can take advantage of that space. And you can reduce them. I don't think you really ever want to eliminate them. They are just part of that transition that we very often see with this. And it's just that they're more vigorous than some of the other things that were in the mix.
Thank you very much, Rich. We did get an email from Luke in Verona. He's having dieback in the center of his Fall Fiesta maple. It's 9 years old, and he's fearing it is verticillium wilt. Psyllium wilt, and we'll have it confirmed by the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab. But if he needs to replace it, what varieties of trees are resistant to it? And do you have a suggestion for another fast-growing shade specimen tree?
Okay, so that's a great question. So first off, I'm going to say don't. It might be verticillium wilt. Verticillium wilt is a fungus. It's a soil-borne fungus, so it gets in the soil, it comes up in the roots, and it plugs that vascular system. So we talked about that earlier, where anything that breaks that connection from the roots to the top of the tree is going to cause symptoms like this. So it might be verticillium. And verticillium is out there, no question about it. But 9 times out of 10, when I get this question about maples, it's not verticillium. It's something else. And it could be things like, again, looking at damage to the trunk. Are there any wounds on there? Is there bad branch structure? When you say that it's just the center of the tree, I'm wondering if there's multiple narrow angled crotches up there that only one section of it, and it happens to be the center section, has been strangled and is dying off. Another thing that's really common with maples is that it might have a girdling root. So underground, there might be a root circling around and it strangles the trunk right under the soil. If the tree was planted too deeply at first, if you don't see a root flare at the soil surface and it looks more like straight in like a telephone pole, then that tree might have been planted too deeply and it might be rotting underground and again breaking that connection. So there are lots of things that can cause this. And sending a sample to Brian Huddleston in the Disease Diagnostics Clinic is a wonderful idea. I think that typically if you do get verticillium listed, Brian sends you a list of plants that are not susceptible to it. And otherwise, you can just Google plants resistant to verticillium, you'll get a whole list of them. And you are right to be concerned about not planting like an ash. Well, we wouldn't plant an ash anyway, but ash get verticillium. I think lilacs get it. So there are some that can get it and some that don't get it. So you're right to look at an option that is not susceptible to it. But again, getting that diagnosis first is absolutely your best bet. I'm just saying chances are it's not that.
Fingers crossed. Okay. Patty and Eden, what's your question or comment?
Hello. Hello. So when you were talking about mowing off the wild parsnip, I had a friend who did that in Minnesota, and he was wearing shorts to walk behind more. And he got a horrible, horrible blistering, and he had to go to the emergency room.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes, you are absolutely right. If you are mowing it, and I should have mentioned that, if you are mowing off wild parsnip, it's the oils in the plant, if they get on your skin and you are exposed to sun, you get this horrible blistering sunburn. So you have to avoid that. You need to have long clothes on. Even, this is a great way to use your COVID masks yet, cover your face. Even you don't want any kind of that sap getting on you. A walk behind mower, oh my gosh, that would be really much more risky than like a side discharge riding mower. But do it on a calm day so its stuff isn't blowing back at you. And no matter what, it's best if you do it in the evening when the sun is really, really low. And even with that, come in, get your clothes in soapy laundry and get all that oil and everything washed off of those clothes. Take a soapy warm shower and get that all off. And just to be safe, stay out of the sun the next day, because after about 24 hours, you're fine. But it's not like poison ivy where the sap causes a rash. It's that it makes you extra photosensitive. So it's connected to sun exposure when you have that sap on your hands. So thank you, or on your body. So thank you very much for calling in and reminding everybody of that. You have to be careful with that weed. That's why it's so undesirable.
Yes. Thank you, Patty. I'm so glad that you did call in about that. If you want to see some horrible pictures, just Google that, what it can do to people. It's not just a little bit of sunburn, people. It's horrible.
No, and it leaves permanent scarring.
It does.
It is awful.
Yeah, it is. So be very, very careful. Jody in Brooklyn, what can we help you with?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question, weeds come up all the time, and I'm fighting them in my garden, as most of us are. What truly is the best way to knock down those weeds? My garden's about 1,000 square foot. And then my other question, I've encountered chiggers. I don't know if it's in my vegetable garden or a flower garden the last two summers. And what in the world can I do other than to take precautions on my skin itself, preventatives? Is there anything else that comes to mind that would help with that?
Okay, so in a vegetable garden, my best weed control is mulching. And what I really recommend is everybody's out there this weekend planting the final vegetable garden stuff is when the weeds are tiny, like an inch or two, or haven't even germinated yet, is to put down everywhere where you don't have plants a layer of cardboard and then top that off with some kind of mulch, whatever you have available. It could be straw. It could be leaves left from last year. It could be grass clippings. Just let them dry out on the driveway for a day or two so they don't get green and stinky. It could be pine needles, whatever you have available. And basically that mulch, the purpose of it is to kind of hold down the cardboard so it doesn't blow away. And when you do that, and this is what I do, I've been saving cardboard all winter. Luckily, we've gotten a few purchases with big boxes this year. So it prevents the weeds from growing in the first place. So then you never have to pull them except right next to your plants, but the in between your tomatoes, all that sort of a thing. And cardboard is organic and it will rot away throughout the year. So by fall, it'll be kind of rotted away. The mulch will be on top of it, rotting away a little bit. It can be worked into the soil as organic matter. And it not only keeps the weeds from sprouting, but it keeps it cleaner if you want to walk through the garden if it's muddy. And if you're growing tomatoes, it prevents the soil from splashing up on the bottom leaves and starting the common tomato blight diseases. So that is the best thing that you can do. If you've already got some weeds that are, 5-6 inches tall growing up, pull them out or chop them off with your favorite garden tool and then put down cardboard and mulch. And that is absolutely the best way to reduce the maintenance in your garden and increase your harvest. I just can't say enough about that. As for the chiggers, I'm not a chigger expert, and that might be something we could talk to PJ Leash, our insect specialist, on. But, they're out in the garden where their habitat is, and short of, fumigating that all with an insecticide, which we really wouldn't recommend because there's not anything that would kill chiggers and not all the beneficial insects as well. Usually it's more a case of, as you mentioned, protecting yourself from exposure to them. But there might be a better answer on chiggers. I just don't have it.
Yeah, contact PJ or even look on the website. His website probably has something too. So thanks, Jody. Appreciate that call. Next is Glenn in Middleton. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to express some caution about Tordon. And it wouldn't matter if it was Tordon K is one formulation or Tordon RTU is another formulation. These both contain picloram as an active ingredient. And with all these materials, of course, the label is the rule, and the label is federal law. And for both of these Tordon materials, it states quite clearly on the label that these are to be used in forest and non-crop areas, roadsides, railroads, along power lines, sites like that, which it does not include residential sites. So I don't know who sells this for residential use, but it really shouldn't, according to the label, be used in residential areas. And then,
okay, thank you, Glenn. Diana?
Yeah, and that's a really, really good point. So whenever you choose to use any kind of a pesticide, whether it's an herbicide, insecticide, or anything else, you must read that label start to finish, and you must follow all of the rules on there. And that's why I had mentioned, too, when Tordon came up, that there are some other products like brush killer that includes triclopyr that are maybe a little more friendly for the residential kind of a case. Tordon is kind of, I'm going to say it's a little bit of overkill. So for the question had come up when it was killing buckthorn, and triclopyr is, you can find it on the shelf at, you know, any of the garden centers and that, and it's usually labeled as brush killer, and triclopyr is more the active ingredient on it, and maybe easier to get a hold of and stuff too, and it's very, very super effective. So that's a really, really good point. Make sure you're reading the label, using it in the place that you should be using it, not using it where you shouldn't be using it, and always follow the label instructions. If you're not using the label and following the label instructions, you're technically breaking the law. And that includes with, you know, if it's a concentrate, mix it to the rate on the label. Do not make it stronger. It actually might be less effective if it's stronger. So thank you for that reminder.
Yes, definitely, Glenn. We really appreciate it. And Diana, we appreciate you being with us once again. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, we're done already.
We are. It does, doesn't it? Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. Have a great summer.
Thanks, you too, Jill.
We've been talking with Diana Alfuth. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Coming up next Friday on Garden Talk, we're taking the show on the road to broadcast live from Bayfield in Bloom. Doors will be open at 10 a.m. Admission is free, but we ask that you register at wpr.org/presents. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well and enjoy your weekend.